Like most of you, I'm hoping that things will get back to normal soon, and we can hang out with our friends, go to the bar, and even travel. If you're wanting to keep yourself preoccupied while we wait for some normalcy, download Best Fiends. It's been keeping me preoccupied during the past while, and it's a great game filled with cute characters, which is a refreshing break from true crime writing. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. There's thousands of levels and tons of characters. I'm on level 291, but there's new puzzles to solve each and every day. It's one of those games where 30 minutes really feels like 30 seconds. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and it's fun to play. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I need a break while writing. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Today's episode is sponsored by City of Ghosts, a brand new supernatural neo-noir mystery podcast set in New York City. I'm about to play a preview of City of Ghosts. The first and second episode are being released on the 12th of October, so go to your favourite podcast app and subscribe right now. I think that you're going to love it.
It's 1999, New York City.
Where am I?
Who are you?
Eleanor? Oh, shut up!
Bridget Lundy Payne stars in a new supernatural neo-noir audio drama.
The voices, they're back.
City of Ghosts.
I understand this is beyond your usual scope.
So two deaths and an attempted third.
Must mean we're onto something big.
Men like them have fortresses built around them.
What good does sticking your neck out do, especially in this city?
Still, just be careful.
Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Do be well, Eleanor.
Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In summer of 2016, a married mother of one would vanish after leaving her home in Avondale Heights, Melbourne, Australia. The disappearance would immediately baffle investigators and hold the collective attention of the local community, as well as the community further afield. Soon enough, however, bizarre allegations regarding the family's relationships would be publicized in the media, launching the case into sensationalism. It was the 30th of June 2016 when police in Melbourne received a phone call from a man named Boris Rostevsky. He said that his 47-year-old wife, Karen Rostevsky, was missing. He informed police that around 10 a.m. the day beforehand, he and Karen had gotten to an argument at their home on Oakley Drive, located in Avondale Heights. He said that the argument was relating to financial issues that they were having with their family-run boutique, and that Karen had left their home, stating that she wanted to go and clear her head. He said that she never came home, and he was extremely concerned for her welfare.
We had a bit of an argument in regards to the store figures and how she was going to, you know, improve them, and that she might have just walked down the street or just to clear her head. Just give us a call or give the police a call or, you know, just give anyone a call.
Karen's phone had been switched off so nobody could get in contact with her, and she hadn't used her debit card, which of course led to immediate concerns. However, Boris would state that she had left the family home with $850 in cash. According to Boris, Karen had left the home to clear her head in the past, but she would never be gone for more than a couple of hours, and this behaviour was completely out of character. He stated, "She has always walked back in the door after calming down, and this time we've got concern, and that's why we made the report to police." Investigators working on the disappearance would appeal to the public for help in searching for Karen. They said that they were immediately concerned for her welfare, because the disappearance was completely out of character. Missing person flyers would describe Karen as standing at around 160 centimetres and of slim build with shoulder-length brown hair. She was last seen wearing a black jacket and jeans. You can see a photograph of the missing person poster on the Photocast app. Karen was a married mother of one, and she ran the Bella Blue boutique, located on Taylor's Lakes at the Water Garden Shopping Centre. Karen was a fashion designer and she sold her designs in the store and even offered a styling service for those who were unsure of what kind of style suited them most. Her friend Samuel Johnson described her as a community champion who was universally loved. She was said to be very sensitive, generous and intelligent. In fact, Karen and Samuel had become friends when Karen offered to donate specially made gowns to his sister, who had undergone a double mastectomy in her fight against breast cancer. The Rostevsky family lived in an extremely lavish home, worth more than $1 million. From the backyard, there was access to a picturesque walking path, which offered amazing views of Melbourne CBD and the Dandenong Ranges. They had a 21-year-old daughter together, Sarah, who was attending university while living at home with her parents. You can see photographs of the family home as well as the family on the Photocast app. Following the disappearance, Sarah would make an emotional plea to the public, asking them to please assist in the search for her mother. She said that she had reached out to all of her mother's friends on Facebook, yet none of them had seen her. She said that she was completely desperate for her mother to return home and couldn't understand what may have happened to her. The family would print out missing person posters and plaster them throughout the area. As investigators combed the area, around the Maribyrnong River, which was located behind the family's home. The following week, it would be revealed that Boris had been interviewed in regards to his wife's disappearance. It's quite common when somebody goes missing that those closest to the missing person are interviewed, so this really wasn't out of the ordinary. However, just the following day, investigators released the crushing revelation that they feared that Karen may have been murdered. Meanwhile, investigators obtained a search warrant for the family's home and could be seen removing two cars from the property for examination. As the media congregated outside, Boris's brother, Vic Rostevsky, said that investigators had also interviewed another local man in regards to Karen's disappearance. However, this is a claim that the investigators would deny. Vic would state that the entire family were really concerned for Karen's well-being. He said, "If you're still alive, talk to us. If you don't want to talk to your husband, give me a call or my wife." While Boris had been released without charge and he wasn't named as a suspect or a person of interest, that didn't stop the rumours that he was somehow involved in his wife's disappearance from circulating around the area. During a press conference, he was asked by a reporter from Channel 7 if he had murdered Karen. He was standing with his arm around their daughter, Sarah, who was obviously very distressed. He didn't respond, but Karen's aunt Patricia interjected and said that he was too distraught to speak. She also said that the question was extremely inappropriate, and the family were focusing on trying to find Karen. Patricia went on to say that if anybody had any information, no matter how insignificant they thought it was, to please come forward. She said that 2 weeks had passed, and they had not received any tips or leads in the disappearance. She said that those 2 weeks had been an absolute nightmare. Sarah would plead with her mother to come home and said that she had gone ballistic after Boris suggested ways to improve the business. Investigators revealed that they, along with volunteer searchers, had searched a 60-hectare area between Canning Reserve and Afton Street, which ran along the Maribyrnong River, but said that they were going to be expanding that search area. Inspector Stephen Dennis said that they feared the worst for Karen, adding that they hadn't been able to trace her phone since it had been switched off. They said that Karen may have had a gold-coloured Coach handbag and a purse with her, and released photographs of them in the chance that somebody somewhere may have come across them. Just the day after the awkward press conference, investigators would state that the security cameras at the family's home did not capture Karen leaving the home that morning. The neighbours also said that they had not seen her on the morning that she vanished. Shortly thereafter, they would disclose that they had abandoned their search in the bushland area near Karen's home because they were satisfied that she, or any evidence of her, was not there. They said that they were shifting their attention to a second area, but they were keeping that area undisclosed. They also asked the public to review any CCTV footage, which may have come from their homes or their businesses, which could help piece together Karen's movements on the day that she vanished. An investigation into the family's affairs would uncover that Karen and Boris had been experiencing mounting financial issues. As a matter of fact, a business landlord had staked a claim over their home. The owner of the shopping centre where Karen had a retail shop had lodged a caveat over Karen and Boris's home because they had not paid rent. The couple's financial issues dated back over 10 years when the rag business collapsed and they owed almost $600,000 in unsecured debts. When this business collapsed, Boris lost a $290,000 loan he had made to the business, while Karen lost $30,000 and other members of the family lost $55,000. A couple of days later, a man would come forward to reveal that he was Karen's stepson. 31-year-old Anthony Rickard was the son of Boris from a previous relationship and he had lived with the family for several years. He stated that he did not kill Karen, but said that he did have a motive to hurt her, and that motive was anger over a family conflict. He further stated that he could not account for his movements on the day that Karen disappeared. He said all of these things during a very bizarre interview, in which he revealed that he'd been battling a drug addiction. The interview was with the Geelong Advertiser, and Anthony told them that he had called Karen up around 10 days before she disappeared to confront her about a family conflict, although the newspaper refused to reveal what that conflict was. He said that he had been interviewed by investigators at Sunshine Police Station when he was there on an unrelated matter. He said that they asked him if his father had been in the area and whether he had any other properties. They apparently asked him if he killed his stepmother, to which he replied, "I would have liked to." Anthony would then speak with the Herald Sun, where he once again said that he would have liked to kill Karen. When questioned, he shrugged and laughed before chillingly stating, "I'm very capable." He admitted that he was angry and certainly had the motive to want his stepmother dead. He said that he was troubled by his nightmare childhood and said that he had recently upped his intake of methamphetamine. He went on to state that when he was 14 years old, he moved to Avondale Heights with his father, Boris, his stepmother, Karen, and his half-sister, Sarah. He went on to again state that a family conflict had torn the family apart before criticising Karen and then stating, "I don't hate her because I can't. She showed me love." He would claim that he had kept this alleged family secret buried until around 10 days before Karen vanished. He said, "So I rung her. What I wanted to talk to her about, she knows exactly why." He said that it was a shock when he discovered that she had gone missing and wondered if his call was a trigger. He said that this was the first time he had spoken to authorities about his secret past, but according to relatives, he had previously opened up to them and they were more than prepared to back up his claims. Anthony would claim to investigators that Karen had been planning on leaving Boris once Sarah turned 21. It was her 21st birthday 3 weeks before Karen vanished. Investigators would state that Anthony had told them about the alleged family secret and said that they were taking it seriously. However, they refused to elaborate on what that secret was. Investigators would step up their appeal for information regarding Karen. They once again canvassed her neighbourhood and set up a mannequin which was dressed up like Karen was when she vanished, in the hopes that it would refresh a potential witness's mind. Neighbours of the family would reveal that on the day Karen vanished, Boris had shown up to their homes and asked if they had any CCTV cameras. He said that his wife had gone missing and he was curious to see if any of them had captured which way she went. One neighbour would state that his CCTV footage did not capture Karen, adding that he found the disappearance extremely strange. He questioned why somebody would go for a walk along the valley with their handbag and purse. While Boris had remained quite tight-lipped since the press conference, he would state in the media that it wasn't a case of the CCTV not picking up Karen leaving the house. But in fact, the CCTV cameras at the family's home had stopped working around 5 or 6 months prior. When he was asked if he would be making a fresh appeal for information, he said, "The police have told me not to talk about the case." It would soon enough be revealed in the media that Anthony had claimed to investigators that the marriage between his father and Karen was fake, stating that they had only stayed together for money, image, and for their daughter, Sarah. He once again spoke about the family's secret and said, "A situation developed between myself and Karen, which I'd rather not fully detail at this time." He did, however, state that in 2006, he had approached his father about the situation with Karen and was told that they would sort it out as a family, but nothing ever happened. He said eventually he was kicked out of the home 3 to 5 times and then finally left for good when he was 27 years old. The first month would pass with no sign of Karen. In the middle of August, some more information about the case was released. While Boris had just recently claimed the police told him to stop talking about the case, Victoria Police would then come forward and say that that wasn't the case. A spokesperson said, "Police are not in a position to restrict anyone from speaking to the media." Boris would actually have an interview with the Herald Sun, in which he hit out at what he called incorrect information on the family's financial situation. He said that his main concern was that people were starting to believe that Karen had simply run away because her business had failed and they were in financial trouble. Before the end of August, Boris's brother Vasco would state that he believed that Karen was still alive and was most likely living in China or the US after having fled with a fake passport. He said that the rumours that Boris killed Karen were ludicrous, stating that his brother did not have it in him to kill somebody. Karen had been going overseas to America and Hong Kong for business for the past 10 years or so. Speaking of Karen, he said, "I don't think she will come back. I reckon she's gone for good." The search for Karen would then shift to a rural area in the northwest of Melbourne. Investigators would not disclose why the search had shifted towards that area, but they asked people who lived in the area to check their properties for any changes or any suspicious activity since Karen had vanished. They were only interested in the country areas as opposed to the outer suburbs of the city. While rumours were still circulating regarding both Boris and his son Anthony, it would be uncovered that a current affair had offered Anthony $50,000 to reveal private details about the family. However, when the interview did not go ahead, a current affair blasted Anthony and suggested that he was making a money grab. Anthony refuted this, stating that he hadn't gone to them for money, but instead they had come to him. He alleged that he had declined the offer, saying that it wasn't enough to potentially ruin his life by disclosing personal and sensitive information on television. However, a current affair then claimed that Anthony had sought $200,000, and they weren't willing to pay that. With all of the drama circulating the case and overshadowing the actual disappearance, there was somewhat of a break in the case shortly thereafter when it was announced that Karen's mobile phone had been tracked northwest of the city after she vanished. Furthermore, it was revealed that Boris had told police that he had used Karen's car on the day that she disappeared, and investigators uncovered that Boris's phone had been switched off for around 2 hours on the day that she disappeared. When Boris had been asked what he'd done on that day, he originally didn't mention that he had driven Karen's car. He claimed that the fuel gauge on Karen's car had been faulty, so he took it for a drive along the Calder Highway. And when he was driving, he hit a bump which apparently corrected the fault and he returned home. Karen's phone had pinged to Tars on the Calder Highway at some point after 10 a.m. when Karen vanished. Borce's phone also pinged there at the same time. Her phone was also detected in the vicinity of Gisborne, around 40 kilometres northeast of their home, and then Borce's phone was detected in Digger's Rest, which was nearby on the same day. In addition to combing through the phone records and forensics, investigators had also taken soil samples from both of the cars that the couple owned. As investigators were working that angle, Karen's aunt Patricia would state that she believed that Karen had been murdered and dismissed the theories that she had simply run away. She also lamented that the search for Karen had been turned into a circus by bizarre statements from family members, including Anthony. She said, "All these things that people are saying, which are just random, is making this case a circus." Borce would seemingly agree with this theory. He reportedly told family members that he believed that Karen may have been abducted by somebody who caused her harm. Karen's brother Stephen would come forward to state that he was supporting Borce and believed his version of events. In fact, he lambasted police and said that the community would most likely have a different opinion on the case if it wasn't for the misinformation out in the public, which he accused the police of fueling. The next couple of weeks would pass with really no new information in the case. Rumours were of course rife that Borce was somehow involved in his wife's disappearance, or even Anthony, his son. While it hadn't been properly disclosed what the alleged family secret Anthony spoke of was, there were varied social media postings, some of which were from Anthony himself, which alleged that he and Karen had an affair. Summer turned to fall, and then fall turned to winter. Before the end of the year, it was announced that investigators were returning to the dams and bushland northwest of Melbourne to continue their search for Karen. Dams were drained around Tullern Vale, while 75 volunteers assisted in the search as well as police divers. Investigators would keep tight-lipped as to whether they had been alerted to the area by a tip. In a potential breakthrough, it was revealed that investigators had seized some items from the Tullern Vale area, which they believed could be linked to Karen. Some locals in the area added to the mystery when they said that they had seen Vasco, Borce's brother, at the site of an abandoned restaurant in the area, which had burned down 3 years prior. Investigators had searched the abandoned restaurant months earlier, but they hadn't found anything. They refused to reveal what items they had found, and there would really be no updates until 2 months later, when it was announced that a body had been found. The body of a considerably decomposed woman was found jammed underneath a log at the base of Mount Macedon by somebody who was walking in the area. The general area where the body was found was 52 kilometres away from the home where Karen lived, and according to somebody else who lived in the area, they had seen a man with a shovel sometime there before the grim discovery. While the area was located near a residential area, the location where the body was found was pretty far into the bushland and quite treacherous. The immediate assumption was that the body was Karen, as it was very close to the area where investigators had been searching just 2 months beforehand. She was to be transported to the medical examiner's office for a cause of death to be determined, as well as a positive identity. It's now been 20 years since the tragic events of 9/11, and despite all those years, many of us remember it like it was just yesterday. America, and even the rest of the world, hasn't been the same since. Raphaelian Media, the King of the World podcast series, explores the impact of that day for the American Muslim community through the eyes of the host, who's a high school senior at the time. The 7-part series delves into what it has been like as a Muslim living in America these past 20 years. It's presented in a unique and accessible way, covering important topics such as identity, belonging, mental health, and even attempted murder, alongside related international events of the last 20 years, including the war on terror, spying, discrimination, and fear of others. If you're a fan of long-form series such as Serial or the 1619 Project, then The King of the World is for you. Subscribe to King of the World now, wherever you get podcasts. the following day, the family's worst fears were confirmed when it was announced that the woman had been identified as Karen. The missing person investigation now shifted into a murder investigation. While the cause of death had not yet been determined, based on how Karen's body had been found, partially hidden underneath a log, it was quite clear that she was the victim of murder. Within less than 24 hours, investigators would reveal that they had removed a shovel from the Rostevskys' garage, and forensic testing on the shovel revealed two distinct types of soil. One type matched the soil behind the family's home, which had led them to search along the Maribyrnong River. The second type matched the soil found in the Gisborne, Macedon area, where Karen's body had been found. As they announced this, Borse's defence lawyer, Rob Sterry, announced that Borse was the main suspect in his wife's murder. He said that Borse maintained his innocence and asked the public not to make assumptions on the case.
By his own admission, Karen's husband's lawyer has said that he's a prime suspect.
Correct.
Still a prime suspect?
I'll take out the word prime, and yes, he is a suspect.
Anthony would immediately take to Facebook to point the finger at his own father. He posted, "Borse, you can man up and show that you are not a complete coward. Stop inflicting pain on Karen's family." He also posted a tribute to Karen, which read in part, "All that I've done, I'm sorry. For all you have done to me, I forgive. You're the only person who showed me true love and will always have a place for you in my heart. You are my true soulmate." The story of the man with the shovel that somebody had seen near where Karen's body was found would really become the talk of the town. The person who had seen the man had just dropped his friend's home on the outskirts of Mount Macedon following a party that didn't finish until well into the night. He'd been turning his car around at the intersection of a dirt road when his headlights shone on a man who was walking out of the bushland with a shovel. He said that he joked with the man, "Where did you bury the body?" But the man didn't respond. He just had an expressionless look on his face. It creeped the driver out so much that he rolled off his window and simply drove off before reporting the strange incident to police. Another person would come forward to reveal that they had seen Vasco, Borse's brother, into Lernvale, not too far away from where Karen's body would be found. Vasco would state that he had been directed to the area by a psychic. With rumours circulating that Borse was the main suspect in his wife's murder, his mother would rush to his defence. She referred to her son as a good family man. Investigators working on the case would actually come forward and ask for the speculation to stop. They expressed concern over some leaks and said that such leaks could potentially put the case at risk. The following month, Karen would be laid to rest. Her family held a private funeral at St. John's Uniting Church in Essendon. Borse and Karen's brother, Steve, would be pallbearers, and the emotion on their faces was palpable as they carried Karen's casket towards the hearse. Sarah led the procession, holding a framed photograph of her mother. Reverend Mark Dunn said to the mourners that Karen's death was still under investigation and urged anybody who knew anything to get in contact with police. He said, "We will proceed to offer Karen a send-off with as much dignity as we possibly can." Anthony was noticeably absent at the funeral and would post on his Facebook, "Can't explain it, but I'm unable to go inside." The next couple of months would pass with no information, and people began to fear that the case had gone cold. However, in mid-June, it would be revealed that investigators had CCTV footage from the day that Karen vanished, showing somebody driving a black Mercedes-Benz near Mount Macedon. Investigators believed that this was Karen's car and that Borse had been driving it with Karen's body in the trunk. They had spent the past months tracking down other people who owned such a car and eliminating them as the driver. Borse had admitted to driving Karen's car that day, but claimed that he only drove it as far as the Calder Park Raceway before doing a U-turn and returning home. Detective Inspector Tim Daly would finally publicly admit that Borse was the main suspect in Karen's murder, just like his defence lawyer had suggested months prior. Some more of the evidence against Borse would be revealed. During a search of the home, investigators had taken an iPad, and the search history would show that somebody had Googled how police can detect traces of blood, as well as how to delete phone data, and how police can track phones. It would then be revealed that Vasco, Boris's brother, had been filmed walking into bushland at Mount Macedon, 8 months after Karen vanished. The footage had been recorded by Channel 9's A Current Affair. When they spotted him, they attempted to speak to him, and he appears very startled before returning to his car.
Morning, Vasco. Martin King from Channel 9, Vasco. How are you, mate? Can you tell me what you're doing out here, Vasco? Mate, it's 1 year since Karen disappeared. Vasco, what are you doing out here, mate? Vasco, what are you looking in the bush for? Can you tell me what Vasco, do you think it's suspicious that you're out here, Vasco?
You can watch the footage on the Vodacast app. The net truly was closing in on Boris, and a few weeks later, investigators would reveal that Boris could not account for all of his movements on the day that Karen vanished. There was 1 hour and 40 minutes, which he could not account for. Meanwhile, Anthony would post on Facebook that he was looking for a backer for an online book that he planned on publishing about Karen. He wrote, "This is my book on one of a kind, and my life's events will have you on your wits' end. Just being able to do this, I have sealed a deal, so just a matter of time." He once again accused his father of killing Karen, and once again said that he and Karen had been having an affair. A couple of months later, Anthony would file a lawsuit against Channel 9 for their claims that he had demanded $200,000 to tell his story. Fume is a non-electrical, natural, wooden, hand-crafted inhaler made to receive the benefits of essential oils, and it's the number one natural way to quit smoking. With Fume, you simply add the oil-infused core and inhale. They taste and smell absolutely amazing and curb cravings. Fume takes all of the benefits of super plants, behavioural science and beautiful design to make quitting smoking that bit easier. My personal favourite oil-infused cores are the peppermint one as well as the black pepper one. They're great to unwind with after a stressful day, especially if you're trying to kick your smoking or vaping habit. Fume really is the perfect alternative. Furthermore, for each Fume that is sold, they feed 6 orphans. So not only are you getting an amazing product, you're supporting children in need. Just head to breathefume.com/morbidology. That is breathefume.com/morbidology and enter code morbidology for 10% off your order. You can even take a quiz to find out what cores are best suited for you. And definitely check out the Quit Naturally pack. Other family members of Karen, including her aunt Marguerite, would hit back at the allegations of an affair that Anthony had made. She said that Karen appeared to be happily married and was dedicated to her daughter. She said, "I would like Karen to be remembered for the person she was. I do think Anthony is not in a good state of mind. He is not doing anything out of any desire to help Karen's memory. He is turning a tragic story into grubby gossip." Then in December, Boris was arrested and charged with Karen's murder. Defence lawyer Rob Sterry said that Boris would be pleading not guilty. The arrest hadn't really come as a shock. It had been apparent for quite a while now that the investigation had zoned in on Boris. Karen's cousin Lisa Gray would say to the Herald Sun that the family always had faith that investigators would get to the bottom of Karen's murder and expressed her gratitude. Her brother Stephen said that the arrest had brought them one step to finding some kind of closure. The committal hearing was scheduled for July, and it had been announced that both Sarah and Anthony would be called as witnesses. However, just days before it was scheduled to begin, Anthony was arrested at his home in relation to a number of outstanding warrants, including failing to answer bail. The committal hearing began on the 16th of July 2018. The purpose was to decide whether Boris would be standing trial for the murder of Karen. The prosecution were contending that Boris had murdered Karen at some point between 8:58 a.m. and 10:43 a.m. on the day that she vanished during an argument over finances. It would be revealed that Boris and Karen had more than $1 million of debt when Karen disappeared, and that Boris had decided to work an Uber driving shift on the day that she disappeared, before attending a family dinner. Prosecutor Matt Fisher said that he then drove Karen's Mercedes, a mobile phone, to the park. Investigators had tracked the car using mobile phone data, and it matched the location the CCTV footage captured their Mercedes near the dump site. He went on to say that Borth had told investigators he had driven Karen's car that day, but the routes he described were implausible. He said that a reenactment of the route he allegedly had taken allowed for 20 minutes at the park to dispose of the body. That night, when he had family dinner, he didn't tell anybody that Karen was missing. Prosecutor Fisher also said that a cause of death for Karen could not be determined due to advanced decomposition. Sarah would give evidence about the relationship between her parents. She said that her mother was the more aggressive one. She was asked for an example of a disagreement between her parents, and responded by saying that her father would sometimes go to the shop and buy milk, but would come home with junk food. She said, "Mom would say, 'But now I'm going to eat them and my thighs will get fat.'" She said that these arguments weren't regular and said that they were a close family. She also said that after arguments, her mother would go on a walk to clear her head. Prosecutor Fisher asked Sarah when the last time this had happened, but she couldn't recall a specific time. According to Sarah, she hadn't grown up in a family where there were major arguments, and said that when her mother disappeared, her father appeared to be extremely worried about her. She said, "People that actually knew him and know him knew he was distressed." She claimed that the reporting of the family's finances was incorrect, and Prosecutor Fisher questioned her knowledge of her parents' finances. Sarah responded that she was an only child and lived at home with her parents. She said that if they were talking about money, she would have heard it. Evidence would also be presented in relation to the supposed faulty fuel gauge. Borth had claimed he took Karen's car out to try and fix the issue. It would be revealed that tests had been conducted on the car, and they found that the car did have a consistently faulty fuel gauge. Two witnesses would then testify about seeing a black Mercedes in the Mount Macedon area on the day that Karen vanished. Senior Constable Adrian Kerr, who had gone to the family's home a couple of days after Karen disappeared, said it appeared as though furniture had been moved. He said that a rug was placed oddly on one side of the room, and indentations on the carpet indicated that furniture had been removed. Dr. Matthew Sorrell would also testify about CCTV footage of the black Mercedes. He said that it was unlikely that the driver was Karen, adding that the driver probably had the same physical characteristics of Borth, such as grey, short hair. While Sarah had portrayed her father as a loving man, security staff at the shopping centre where the clothing store was offered a strikingly different portrayal. Senior Constable Kerr said that when they interviewed two security guards, they both said that Borth was difficult to deal with and oftentimes angry. Karen's Aunt Patricia would also testify that Borth had initially told her that he had taken Karen's car out that morning to get quotes from two garages to fix the faulty gauge, but then later claimed that he had taken the car out simply to refuel it. She said, "He said he missed the turn-off for the garage, and then he decided to go to the shop, but he missed the turn-off for that as well. He then decided to go home." She said that she could tell Borth was not assisting investigators or even attempting to find Karen himself. There would be some testimony in regards to Karen's cause of death. Pathologist Stephen Cordner said he was unable to determine how she had actually died, but said that she could have died from a head injury, despite the fact there was no sign of a skull fracture. He said he found that part of the bone in the neck was broken, adding that it was a possibility she died from a head injury, strangulation, or blunt force trauma. Defence attorney David Hallow said, "They're all just possibilities. We just don't know." To which Dr. Cordner replied, "That's right." Pathologist Yelania Barber, who had conducted the autopsy, said that while they couldn't determine how Karen had died, the fact that her body was found hidden questioned the mechanisms of death. It would be revealed that investigators had bugged Borth's home. One recording captured Sarah doubting her father's story. She said, "You know what I want to know? You were out of the house for 2 hours. Your phone is off for 2 hours. They pinged you in the Calder. So you were driving? Bohr suggested investigators were trying to plant evidence, to which Sarah replied, "Well, that doesn't make sense." He then told Sarah he had actually driven to the Calder freeway to buy water pipe tobacco, but hadn't told investigators because he didn't know if it was legal or not. The Calder freeway was in between the Rostevskys' home and Mount Macedon, where Karen's body would be found. After a 9-day committal hearing, Defence Hallows would ask Magistrate Sue Cameron to throw out the murder charge. He said that there was evidence for Bohr to stand trial on manslaughter, but said that there was not enough for the charge of murder. Prosecutor Fisher rebuffed this. He said that despite the fact they didn't know how Karen was killed, there was distinguishing features in Bohr's behaviour following her disappearance, which a jury could use to find him guilty of murder. These included waiting 24 hours to report Karen missing, inconsistencies on his whereabouts and the pings from both his phone and Karen's phone, going up Calder Freeway before they were both turned off, as well as the CCTV footage of the black Mercedes, which investigators believed was driven by Bohr's. He stated, "This isn't just an accidental killing. Something happened in the house. The accused man engages in behaviour soon after he has either killed her or caused her serious injury." Ultimately, Bohr's would be ordered to stand trial on the murder charge and he pleaded not guilty. However, just the day before Bohr's was scheduled to stand trial, he appeared in court where he pleaded guilty to the manslaughter of Karen. He did not give an account of what happened that day, and he didn't have to, as the court cannot compel somebody to take the stand. The sentencing phase would be to follow, but before then, a Supreme Court ruling would reveal that following Karen's disappearance, Bohr's had constructed a web of deceit to mislead his family as well as Karen's family. Police taps had caught him arranging for a new mobile phone number and warning somebody that they're listening. In a phone call, he had told a friend that he went to Lalor on the morning that Karen had vanished, but he didn't tell this to police. In other phone calls, he urged friends and family not to speak to police, and phone records showed that when Karen vanished, Bohr's hadn't called anybody to inquire as to whether they had seen Karen or knew where she was. It would also be revealed that Bohr's had changed his version of events numerous times. He had first of all claimed that Karen had gone upstairs to cool off after the argument, before claiming she immediately left the house through the front door, before then changing that version, claiming she left out the garage. He first of all claimed that he had spent the entire day at home doing book work, before stating that he went out to drive for Uber. Bohr's would finally admit that he had driven Karen's black Mercedes, but said it was to try and fix a faulty fuel gauge. In an intercepted phone call with Sarah, he said he had actually gone out that morning to buy shisha tobacco, but claimed he didn't tell police this because he wasn't sure if it was legal. It would also be revealed that when Current Affair called Bohr's to tell him a body had been found at Mount Macedon, he chillingly replied, "Well, it's got nothing to do with me." Bohr's defence team would submit that Bohr's had not intended on killing his wife and had disposed of her body simply because he was afraid of going to prison and ruining his relationship with his daughter, with whom he was close to. Bohr's had admitted to killing, not murdering, his wife after an argument over their financial situation, stuffing her body into her own black Mercedes and dumping her at Mount Macedon, turning both of their phones off en route. The pleas to manslaughter had come after Supreme Court Judge Christopher Beale ruled that Bohr's actions after Karen went missing could be used as evidence that he had killed her, but said that it could not be relied on to prove murderous intent. This meant that the murder charge was withdrawn and Bohr's pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of manslaughter. Following the guilty plea, Anthony would claim he had persuaded his father to plead guilty by saying that he would reveal the relationship he secretly had with Karen. He said, "I am responsible for this. I gave him an ultimatum. I told him, if you don't get up and be a man, I'll go to the witness box and tell them exactly what happened behind closed doors." While much of the family had turned on Bohr's, Sarah would stand by her father. She provided a character reference for the Supreme Court in which she referred to him as loving, caring, and sympathetic. She wrote, "All I can try to do is communicate the truth of how good of a dad and husband he was to my mum and I." She even said that she had hoped the love her parents had for one another and the marriage they shared was something that she could someday experience herself. At the sentencing phase, family members were able to provide victim impact statements. Karen's aunt, Patricia, cried as she recollected how she had printed and distributed missing person flyers after Karen had vanished. Speaking of Bourse, she said, "It was very uncomfortable to watch as he manipulated his family. He and his vicious lies were agonizing." She accused Bourse of bullying Sarah into defending him. Karen's brother Stephen said that he found out on Facebook that Karen was missing and said that when he finally spoke to Bourse, all he would talk about was himself. He stated, "At what stage can we say enough is enough when it comes to domestic violence?" Sarah refused to provide a victim impact statement for her own mother. Bourse Rostevsky would be sentenced to a maximum of 9 years in prison with a 6-year non-parole period. The sentence was an absolute slap in the face. According to Justice Beale, the reason he chose such a lenient sentence was because he could not determine whether the offence was in the mid or upper range of manslaughter. A conviction of manslaughter carried a maximum 20-year sentence. Prosecution would appeal the lousy sentence, labelling it manifestly inadequate. The appeal would be successful and Bourse would be resentenced from a maximum of 9 years to a maximum of 13 years, with a non-parole period of 10 years.
No truly comparable cases to this one. This case was atypical. There was no evidence of earlier domestic violence or serious discord.
While it was certainly an improvement, 10 years for taking a life really doesn't equate to justice. In February of 2020, Sarah granted an interview in exchange for a 6-figure sum. She said that her father was hurting as much as she was over her mother's death, despite the fact he had been the one who caused it. She said that she stood by her father and would continue to do so until he is released from prison.
At the end of the day, he's my father, and I have one parent left, and even though he's pled guilty, I guess sometimes I just find it hard to comprehend that he is guilty, but I think if I was in his position, he would be by my side. I love my dad now, I loved him before, and I'll love him in 11 years when he's home.
There was a weakness in the case against Bourse Rostevsky, and that weakness was that investigators could not find a motivation. However, it could be said that when it comes to partner violence, there really doesn't need to be a main motivation. Time and time again, we hear about people killing their partners. Some, for example, are in the heat of the moment. Some snap under intense strain. The grim ending of this case was disheartening to most within the area, who felt that Bourse was truly guilty of intentional homicide. While there was some semblance of closure for the family, justice wasn't served for Karen Rostevsky. Her life was worth more than just 10 years, and what truly happened to her that morning will most likely never be known. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a huge thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Lisa and Andy. If you'd like to join me on Patreon, the link is in the show notes, or you can simply search Morbidology on the app or on the website. In return for your support on Patreon, you first of all get my undying love. I also send out a handwritten thank you card, as well as some cool merch. I upload ad-free and early release episodes every single week and full-length bonus episodes each month. It's a cool place to chat about the cases I cover on the podcast, and I'm eternally grateful for all of the support. If you do enjoy Morbidology, I'd love to ask if you could leave a written review on Apple Podcasts. know that they don't really mean anything, but I'd love to hear feedback on the episodes. Also, feel free to follow me on social media. I really love chatting with you all about the episodes, about true crime, and about anything really. So please feel free to hit me up there. Also remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Also stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Beyond the Rainbow. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe and have an amazing week.
Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. I'm CJ, host of Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT. My episodes focus on crimes committed by and against the LGBTQ community. I've covered cases you probably have heard of, such as Matthew Shepard, Brandon Tina, and the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre, as well as some lesser-known cases like the murder of Ray Hainish, the Australian Gay Beat murders, and the suspicious disappearance of Lisa Lynn Stone. I cover cases brought to me by listeners like Penny Brummer, who I believe was wrongfully convicted, taboo cases such as lesbian corrective rape and murder in South Africa, and Pray the Gay Away camps. I discuss gay serial killers, women who pretend to be men to hook up with other women, and trans murders. I'm opinionated and uncensored. I know I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but surely I'm someone's shot at tequila. No matter what your gender or orientation in life might be, please join me as I tackle rainbow crimes in search of unicorn justice. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay, unless you're a murderer.